If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
The solution is always just more people. You got to have a bigger database, a bigger network, more partners that you can call on. And the bigger that is, the more comfortable you'll feel, so that you're not just saying, okay, if I need, you know, $8 million raise on a deal, well, I know that I've got, say, $15 million in people around me that I can bring around to try to get this deal done.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
For many years, Jason Stubblefield had been developing software solutions for various government agencies. In that, he realized that Social Security is not likely for his generation, and he was left with a disturbing and ominous reality. Either he could take charge of his retirement future, or he would be at the mercy of a failing institution. Jason now provides safe and stable investment vehicles for investors. He spends his time helping others take charge of their own finances and futures by investing in multifamily real estate. Jason is driven and passionate about helping everyday investors with aspirations of generating long-term wealth. Jason, welcome to the show.
Sam, thanks for having me, man. Glad to be here.
The pleasure's all mine. I normally get to interview fellow Tennesseans, although you don't live in Tennessee anymore, let alone University of Memphis graduates. So we share that in common as well. It's great to have you on here. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, great. So I started with multifamily investing, I guess, was living in D.C., right? I had graduated, went up to D.C., was working government contracting, and I was doing single family. You know, sort of mentioned in my intro, I found out that was going to be a slow process, and retirement, regular 401k wasn't something I was looking forward to. So I went into single families for a minute and then said, that's going to take too long. So let me look at multifamily. Got into multifamily. I started investing in Tennessee with a 34 unit apartment building. And it was something that was beat up, needed a lot of work, about 50% vacant. And I jumped in. I said I was going to do it. I knew the numbers. I knew just enough to be dangerous, right? To sort of get in there and make some mistakes, which is what I did. But I learned a lot. Long story short, that catapulted me. I got that property turned around. I was able to refinance it, still own it to this day. I got all my capital back out and then got into syndication. So through apartment syndications, I began to scale a little bit. My next acquisition was something that wasn't that far away, but 48 unit syndication. And then I started scaling up. So to skip over a lot of what's in between there, right now I'm a little over 1,000 units in about four.
Wow, that's really cool. So that first deal, you said it was how many units? 34 units?
Yes, sir.
And it was 50% vacant.
Correct.
And you had no previous experience in multifamily.
I did not.
Wow. I want to hear that. Like, what did you do? How'd you turn it around? How did you have the courage and the fortitude just to jump in?
I knew that it had potential, right? The most interesting component to it was the fact that it supported itself being 50% vacant. And I was like, okay, well, if this thing supports itself off of 50%, you know, if I can get the other 50%, I got a pretty good deal on my hands here. And so that was my carrot, I guess, that gave me enough courage to go ahead and start chasing it. And once I got in there, you know, I realized that, hey, there was a lot of things that I didn't know. And I was honestly undercapitalized going in. So it made me sort of get scrappy and have to hustle a little bit to figure out how to turn all that around. It wasn't easy, but, you know, once I got it done, I had a lot that I had learned and I could use that, you know, going into my future.
You said you were undercapitalized. What did that problems did that create?
A lot, right? So part of my initial strategy was saying, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to renovate the vacant units. And then I'm going to be able to refinance once I get those vacant units occupied. What I didn't realize is, well, if you take over as a new owner, the old tenants started to not pay, started to move out. And so when it comes to being capitalized, I was only capitalized thinking, hey, if I renovate, you know, X amount of units, say 10 units, right now I've got a good enough occupancy and I can go ahead and refinance. But if you renovate 10 and you lose 10, you've basically gone nowhere.
Right.
That's what was happening to me. And I was losing tenants and then I couldn't rent it back because the tenant was living in such a, you know, dilapidated place that no one wanted to rehab. And I didn't want to show that. I'm trying to rebrand the property. So I don't want to try to rent out something that's just old. Now I have to find the money to rehab those units too.
Right. So what'd you do?
I had to get pretty creative. One thing that I didn't know would probably be useful information for the listeners that I could have got the rehab costs put in the loan had I known what I was doing, but I didn't. So I just got the loan in and of itself. And then I was trying to fund the rehab with some of my own money. I had some seller financing, but that money ran out fairly quickly. So what I ended up doing, I pulled money out of my 401k, stuck it in the deal. That helped me hobble along for a little bit. And I was able to refinance it just off of a better occupancy, I'd say, right? Not where it was fully occupied, but I was able to get another lender who could see the vision and they gave me a little bit of capital. And I went and used that again. And I actually ended up refinancing the property probably two times, just hobbling along and putting my own money in it. And yeah, it was an interesting process. But
yeah, I'd say so. So was this a deal you had done solely on your own?
It was.
Okay. So you didn't have any investors to answer to. There was nobody else that
thankfully I did. You know, yeah.
Right. There are blessings or advantages and disadvantages to having investors along for the ride.
Yeah.
Becoming more responsible for their capital and kind of, you know, getting it done, you know, in a different way. Typically, it's some of the ways that works out when you have to answer to other people and how you're handling their money. But when it's you and you just get down and dirty and all right, well, I'm going to dump more 401k money in and make this thing happen. Good for you. And you said you still own it to this day.
Correct.
That's awesome. So you got it refinanced a couple of times. Was it expensive when you refinanced it?
Overall, but you know, it was necessary for me, right? Because I needed to get some capital out of it so I could put back into the property to continue to rehab.
Right. Is your strategy to buy and hold really in perpetuity, or do you guys ever intend on taking deals full cycle?
That was my initial plan, right? So when I started, I was like, hey, I'm just going to sort of refinance this property and roll on into another property. And what happened along that journey was I realized that it was going to take a long time because I had to wait on the refinance period. So I probably had, I don't know, let's call it 6 to 8 months where I'm just waiting on units to turn, contractors are doing that thing. And what got me into syndication was that. I was like, hey, I'm not doing anything anymore, right? You know, we've got a system down now and I like to continue doing something. And that's when some peers of mine said, well, you know, you can get into syndication, you can use other people's money. And that's what triggered me to say, okay, well, while this project's going on, I don't have any money to put in. Let me see if I can go learn syndication model. And then that allowed me to keep growing.
Right. Yeah. Was this 34 unit self-managed?
It was me and my dad, actually. So I was living in DC at the time. My dad was there sort of like my boots on the ground. And we just kind of bootstrapped everything. I mean, I remember Googling leases, right? How to make a lease, how to come up with, you know, processes, systems, all that stuff.
Wow. Yeah, you really did bootstrap it. Yeah. I mean, good for you. That's kind of a heroic story because most people don't, one, just jump in, let alone bootstrap it. I know you said, I'm sure you're not using Google for your potential lease terms anymore.
No, I try not to.
Right. So what happened from there? How did you scale?
Yeah. So next I started syndicating, right? And then I syndicated another 48 unit. And then things started to get a little bit bigger because through syndication, I realized that, hey, there's a lot of other bigger players. And so I could start to play a role on bigger teams instead of having to be the quarterback of the deal or what I run everything myself. So I partnered with some other groups, scaled and started doing some apartment investing in Texas, right? And some of those were rather largest, like belonged to like a 350 unit. Another larger project was 529 units. And so this is where I'm tapping into and I'm providing value through my underwriting. I'm also providing value through capital, but I'm not necessarily having to do everything because they've got a good structure there, right? So I'm a general partner in all the units, but I don't necessarily have to do everything. I was like, okay, this is nice. So started to do that, began to scale, and also buying, right? So our latest acquisition was another apartment not too far away over in Augusta, Augusta, Georgia, and then still looking to scale and grow there.
Right. So you've got things both on the where you're the direct active sponsor, and on the other front, you have really you're co-GPing with some other sponsors as well.
Correct.
Right. That's interesting blend. You know, a lot of times we see either people are just a co-GP or they are only the active direct sponsor. You found a way to mix the two. What's scaling been like? I mean, do you have, you know, team members in-house? What's it been like hiring people if you've hired? What, walk us through kind of how you built out your team.
It starts as an operator. You know, you have to look at a lot of deals before you can find one that works. And that was sucking up a lot of time. So what I did was I hired right now two virtual assistants. What they do is they go out, they search for deals, they tee them up, they run rental comps, they use my underwriting model, and they give that to me sort of already filled out, right? So at that point, and then I hand it off to my acquisitions guy. And my lead acquisitions guy, he comes in and does sort of the fine tuning, looking at the rental comps, looking at our renovation assumptions, looking at the market, saying, hey, we want to, you know, go up here, come down here, you know, whatever it is. And once he's finished looking at it, then we decide, okay, well, where are we on price? And we try to analyze about 10 deals a week, right? Using the analyst and my acquisitions guy, we try to get two offers out a week. So out of those 10, it's just like, hey, it's not going to work. Doesn't make sense. But we make those offers really quick, just email, but we throw our pro forma in the email. So the broker knows, hey, this is where we are. This is where we are on rent projections. Is this offer that you think the seller would entertain? And if they say yes, then we go ahead and submit our formal LOI. If they say no, all right, you know, we consider that an offer, but we're moving on to the next
one. That's really cool. So you do this all with virtual assistants?
Yeah, everyone's virtual.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And that's on the acquisition side. And then we have operations where we have like, it's more my involvement, but my acquisitions guy does a little bit of both, right? On the operation side and on the acquisition side.
That's really cool. So how much time do you spend all the way up to LOI? How much time do you spend on each deal by the time an LOI is submitted?
Maybe 30 minutes before LOI is out. I usually don't get involved until we have agreement from the broker that says, hey, this is really something that we feel like your offer can be competitive. And depending on it, right, I may go in and take a deep dive look to sort of oversee things, but we can definitely do an LOI without my involvement at all.
That's really cool. I mean, you've kind of hit the dream jackpot for a lot of people in developing your systems so that you can consistently generate offers. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that just haven't figured out how to do that in a consistent manner without their direct involvement.
Right.
Have you ever had to go back and test the assumptions in the underwriting and say, well, maybe this was off? Or
Yeah. We've definitely had mistakes that happen out of the process. And sometimes, you know, it's one of the things that you risk. You know, we're going out there is getting an LOI that's a little bit too aggressive, right? You know what I mean? You don't want to be so aggressive on the LOI that you end up having to go in and backtrack a little bit. We try to avoid that, you know, when we can. And, you know, we'll go back. It basically boils down to a conversation with the broker. We say, hey, you know, we thought this was going to happen, but we didn't. But we've learned to be a little bit conservative when we say when we do put anything out. So we try to leave buffer there. So we're not actually hitting our strike price. We want to be about 5% underneath that and see if that gives us some engagement. And if so, then we'll go ahead and dig a little bit deeper and see where we are.
What's it been like developing? I mean, because there's a lot of deals out there. There's a lot of brokers with a lot of stuff that comes out. How have you developed your buy box and what you guys, I don't necessarily want to know what yours is per se, but how did you develop it? And it's so you guys can narrow down what you want to see.
Right. So it really just became by my mentor, right? And sort of following their process. And so saying, okay, well, if they're buying under this criteria and that's who I'm learning from, I should probably buy under that criteria too. It was really just that simple. But what we've been finding out is sometimes you step outside of that box a little bit, but you really have to stick to what you know. So it's a couple of things, right? What can your management team manage and do effectively? And then what do your investors want? And once you have those two things together, then it's like, okay, well, I know I need to look at deals like this because the capital behind me is going to look for a deal that can produce this type of return. And then the manager who's going to ultimately make that goal happen is comfortable managing this type of property.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's not a point I hear very often is taking a look at deals that you know that your management team is capable of handling.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's a different lens that we don't hear a lot about. Talk to us about the money side of things. How's it been like building your investor database, you know, scaling up with syndications? Can you give us some insight on that?
Definitely. It's been a struggle. It's really part of, it's another business in and of itself, right? It's sort of like you have the buying and operation side, but then you also have the capital raising side as well. And so the reason why I had to get to not looking at a deal more than, say, 30 minutes, but I had to because there was a lot of effort needed on raising capital. So I've got like a monthly meetup group that I run. It used to be in person prior to COVID, and now it's sort of scaled on everything virtual, but continuously putting myself out there, attending conferences, making phone calls, and always just sort of having that 15-second speech where, you know, you tell people, hey, this is what I do. And then if they're interested, you know, they'll have a follow-up question and you can sort of talk to them about it.
Right. Did you ever have a deal that you had to pass on because you couldn't get the capital together?
Fortunately, no, because let me say that again. I passed on the deal because I know I didn't have the capital on it. It's a great deal, but let's say it's, at the time, I think we were looking at something like $35 million. And I was like, it's a great deal. And I'm like, how am I going to fund this? And it made no sense, right? Given my current network or how I was going to get there. So I haven't been under contract with something and then said, hey, I couldn't pull it off.
Right.
Yeah. I've been under contract and still struggled, but we've always managed to get to the finish line.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I wasn't asking necessarily if you guys haven't been able to close because of funding, but how have you overcome? Because that is, I think, a common frustration amongst investors.
Right.
Is that, like you said, you'll find a great deal, but you go, oh, I don't know that I'm able to actually get this done. Mm-hmm. So you can't go under contract.
Right.
So what did you do from that point forward? Like, how did you overcome that and say, all right, you know what, from this point forward, we're not going to have that happen again?
Yeah, that basically boils down to you have to get more capital. You have to find more capital. And then all the deals that you look at need to be under the confines of that capital, right? So if you say, hey, I think I could come up with $1 million, then you need to do a property that's going to need, I'll probably say a little less than that, you know, 750, whatever it is. But the way I've managed to scale is just being able to partner with other people who have bigger networks. And so as you start to form those alliances, you know that somebody you have a relationship with is looking for a deal similar to yours. So, hey, if we get together, I feel like my network, I can bring $1 million. Their network may be able to bring $1 million. Now we can do something bigger. And we sort of scale up like that.
Right. Have you run into any challenges with that approach?
There is, right? Because you have to, a lot of people who you may potentially partner with say that they can raise X amount of capital, but they may or may not. And you don't know that until you got a live deal. And that's when you sort of figure things out. The solution is always just more people. You got to have a bigger database, a bigger network, more partners that you can call on. And the bigger that is, the more comfortable you'll feel so that you're not just saying, okay, if I need, you know, $8 million raise on a deal, well, I know that I've got, say, $15 million in people around me that I can bring around to try to get this deal done.
Right. Yeah, I like that line. The solution is more people. That's pretty succinct and very clear and very, very clear. That's cool. What is one thing that you feel like maybe you have done right that others should emulate?
Getting around the right people, finding the right coaches. I think that's probably one of the biggest differential factors in where I've gone. It's just having a network that I could tap.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you develop that network?
It was really just trial and error, but I fell into the right circle and talked to the right people and said, hey, you know, you can find a coach that had a lot of experience and was doing things at a very high level. So that when I was talking with them, you know, on this higher level, everyone who's in their program is also on a high level, which makes me want to scale up as well.
Right. No, that's great. Jason, let's jump here into the final four if we can. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
To go for it, right? To figure out what it is that you want to do and then be able to surround yourself with people who are doing that, and then don't be afraid to take action.
Yeah, that's great. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
Every day I'm trying to learn, to read, to meditate, to make sure I'm the best version of me when I approach the day.
Yeah, that's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
I'm always looking looking for different organizations that I could give to. I allot a certain amount of my income that always goes to that. And then with what I'm doing in my multifamily careers, I'm starting to look more at ways that we can have community development alongside the projects. So looking to not just serve our investors, but also to make sure we're serving the tenants at our communities.
Man, that's great. Jason, for listeners who want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Go into the website, snscapitalpartners.com. We've got some resources there that you can check out, investment lists that you can join if you want to hear about our deals and some trainings.
That's awesome. And that's SNS. What's that stand for?
That's Sam, Nancy Sam. Okay. For snscapitalpartners.com.
Got it. Awesome. Jason, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.